believe that Scissor Man was the scientist. You're talking about Scissor Man's monster. It's Snescapades, a chronological journey through the North American Super Nintendo library with a few pit stops along the way. We play them briefly, we judge them harshly, we rank them. That's pretty much all you need to know. I am Chase Keys.
And I'm Emmy Zero.
And it's spooky season, everyone. Welcome to the Halloween spooktacular of Snescapades. The spooktacular, of course, a word that I definitely just came up with, has definitely never been used by any other podcast or internet show or anything, I'm sure.
You know, you want to know something really dumb? I was just like hanging out with my partner the other day. And I happened across the word spooktacular in relation to something. And I had the really, really dumb thought, which I said out loud before I could even stop myself. Spooktacular? That's like spectacular. It's like, what are you? Yep. And she just looked at me like, yeah, yeah.
Oh, wow.
So that's how my week's been. That's been good. I've really been firing on all cylinders this week in the lead up to Halloween, clearly.
Yeah, I don't normally do a whole lot of stuff for Halloween, but I don't know. We just kind of felt like, hey, let's talk about some Halloween stuff on the podcast today.
Yeah. We got some Halloween stuff to talk about. Just like, we're going to reminisce about our own relationship to the holiday and, you know, what we like in scary media. And then we're going to talk about a spooky game. Well, one of the only really spooky games for the Super Nintendo, I think.
I think so, too. There's a lot of games we could talk about. We could talk about, you know, like monster related things like Super Ghouls and Ghosts or Zombies Ate My Neighbors or Castlevania or
King of the Monsters.
Yeah. King of the Monsters. There you go. Or the other Castlevania game or Ghoul Patrol. There's just not a lot of like really scary games on the Super Nintendo. There weren't really a lot of scary games happening in general, at least not on Nintendo systems around this time.
There were horror games, but they were pretty much confined to, I think, basically to computers at this point. You know, I don't think you really saw that much. Maybe a little bit more on, like, the Mega Drive Genesis PC Engine side of things, but, not really so much on the Nintendo systems, that's certainly for sure. And frankly, not really much of the way in the way of that in America at all. The game we're going to talk about today never even came out in North America. So we're kind of stepping outside of our usual lane here and talking about a Japan-only game that nonetheless is still pretty famous. So I'm excited to do that. I'm excited to talk about it.
But, you know, before we get to that, though, we just kind of wanted to talk about, you know, spooky stuff in general and our relationship to it. Sure. And then we'll branch into a bigger conversation about spooky games. And then we will talk about the subject, the main subject of today's episode, which is the game Clock Tower. We might as well just say it. I mean, we already did the whole Scissor Man bit.
There's no reason to dance around it. Good old Mr. Scissorman. He's here. Snip, snip. And we're going to really look into his work and, what all went on in that big, spooky, abandoned mansion. Before that, though, yeah, let's talk about the season. Let's talk about Halloween, scary stuff. Chase Keys, why don't you give us, just a little rundown of like what your relationship to Halloween is?
Well, my relationship to Halloween is mostly dressing up like characters from video games and TV shows that I really like. Spooky stuff wasn't always really like the big aspect of the holiday that I was looking forward to. I was much more into the cosplay, I guess, even from a young age. In fact, I can definitely still remember like the Halloween costumes I had in grades like 2 through 5. Not sure if I can remember anything other than that, but I was definitely Mario in second grade. I was Mega Man in third grade. In fourth grade, I think I've told the story before. I I was an Acme Crime Net gumshoe from Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego?
Yeah.
And then in fifth grade, I tried my darndest to make a Gambit costume from X-Men. But yeah, it turns out his attire is kind of impossible in reality.
I'm shocked. Truly shocked.
Yeah. How about you? Do you have any like Halloween costumes that you remember from childhood?
I have a few. Yeah. I mean, I loved dressing up for Halloween, not really as specific characters for the most part. Every once in a while, like I think when I was a little kid, I did dress up as, you know, characters from things, but mostly I would just find a really cool, really elaborate monster mask and then sort of build a costume around that.
Oh, nice.
One year I had this really good, it was kind of a slug monster mask where like it had big eye stalks and glass eyes. So it made me like a foot taller and a big sort of gooey, sort of spittly mouth with a big tongue coming out of it. And you saw out through the mouth. That's where the head hole was. That's where the eye hole was. I think I kind of did, you know, I don't really remember like so much all that I did for the rest of the costume. I think I had like a robe or something. Like, I think I was like sort of like a wizard who'd been like transformed or something, you know? And it was really cool. It was really fun. My favorite Halloween costume I ever did was this one. I was like 13 or 14. I don't remember. I remember it was like the last year I went trick-or-treating. And I think the costume basically saved me because I was probably a little bit too old to be going trick-or-treating at that point. But I think the costume is like impressive enough that like people were just like impressed by it. It was double costume. And it was a kind of mask that I don't know if they still make these, but it was basically thin, like a thin latex form, like basically kind of like movie prosthetic makeup, where it was a latex form that you would sort of cut, tailor it to the shape of your face, and then stick it to it with spirit gum, and then use makeup to kind of blend the edges in. So that you looked, it looked really good. And I just had like a basic, you know, like I had like, you know, red devil costume with like a hood. And I had some gloves and a pitchfork. And it genuinely freaked people out a couple of times when I like came around the corner and they saw me because like my face could move and stuff in it. So that was my favorite one for sure.
That's pretty cool. That sounds really cool. I do remember one year, again, I think it was also like for me, like the last year I went trick or treating. So I was probably in middle school, but we had like this hard plastic skull mask, you know, with like the black fabric that goes over to hide the rest of your head.
Yeah, but sure.
The cool thing about this mask though, was that like, The eyes had little holographic skulls in them.
Nice.
So, like, you know, you could see through the eye holes and you could see the other person's eyes, but you'd also see these skull holograms in there. And it was really neat. Wish I still had that mask, frankly. But I think, you know, like I took that mask that year and just kind of fashioned a Grim Reaper costume around it.
Yeah.
And went with that. I think for the last year I went out trick-or-treating. But
that's cool. That's very cool. My family really got into doing the Halloween stuff. One of our big things was to always get just like a block of dry ice from a chemical company.
Oh, yeah.
And keep like a, you know, like a witch's cauldron bubbling away on the front porch so that, you know, there'd always be like mist around it when people were coming up to trick or treat. And yeah, it was, you know, it was just a really great time, and it'd always be horror movies on, you know, cable that we would just have on. It's like a marathon. Sometimes when I was a kid, especially, we would have like kid Halloween parties and stuff, and you know, all of that was just like, it was one of my favorite times of the year as a kid, definitely.
Yeah, it was definitely like, you know, hey, it's time to party, time to get friends together. You know, time to watch scary movies. Didn't really play a lot of scary games with people back then, but I wonder if that's a thing like kids do now at Halloween parties. Like, do they all play scary games? Like, do they all take turns playing Five Nights at Freddy's or something?
It's a good question. I don't know. I don't really know what kids really. There are a lot more scary games now than there used to be. That really goes without saying. There's several just enormous horror game genres that simply did not exist back when no horror game genres really existed. There was like kind of the beginnings of survival horror, right? But unless you had very specific access to something like, I don't know, Alone in the Dark. Like, I mean, I remember being a little freaked out. So this is weird. I loved horror movies as a kid. My parents loved horror movies. Two of my favorite movies when I was like quite a young child were Alien and the great 80s comedy horror movie Return of the Living Dead. I would watch those. I was like 6 years old and I would watch those. But horror games freaked me out. And like even games with like kind of horror adjacent aesthetics like Doom or Diablo freaked me out. I don't know what the deal is with that. They were kind of fascinating to me, but also much, much more unsettling than like a movie could be.
Yeah.
So,
I'm kind of with you there. Like we were not horror movie aficionados in my house. My parents were pretty well, relatively strict with what kind of movies I could watch. Like I remember like, you know, like my dad would be flipping through channels and there, you know, he'd stop on something and then like something horrifying would happen. Like, oh, well we can't watch this. I'm like, well, but wait, now I need to see what happens. What's that is an early childhood memory. I remember, it seemed to happen frequently. Like, you know, my dad would just be flipping through channels and then, oh, there's a horror movie on this random channel over here. We can't watch that. If I caught glimpses of a horror movie where somebody was killed and like, what happened? My dad would say, oh, he's out of the movie now. That was, that's how my dad explained that sort of thing to me back then.
Yeah. I don't know. I just, there were a couple of horror movies that freaked me out really badly in a way that like stayed with me for a long time afterward, but it was not things you'd expect. I already mentioned like I was totally cool with Alien, which I think is genuinely so. Okay, for one thing, I think as like an adult that Alien is probably just one of the best movies that's ever been made.
Agreed.
I also think Alien is genuinely a really, you know, tense and distressing movie. And, you know, I love it. But I just nothing about it, you know, kind of triggered anything that was like too much for me when I was a kid. And I can't really explain that. In contrast, there's a really stupid, really cheesy 80s horror movie called Terror Vision, which is about an alien monster accidentally getting like beamed into a rich family's pirate satellite TV receiver and subsequently killing all of them and wearing their heads as little like finger puppets on its big tongue. And this movie scared the hell out of me. Like, my mom, like, recorded it off TV to show it to me one day because she thought it was so funny. And then I did not think it was funny. And I have no answer to explain why that is, you know?
Yeah.
Like, this is one of the goofiest movies you could possibly imagine. And yet, for some reason, that movie did something to me that I cannot explain. So, yeah. I don't know. It's weird how things affect kids that way. It's very hard to tell, I think, what it's going to do that to them.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think like kind of going from that, you know, maybe this could be a jumping off point, kind of talking about like some of the first like scary moments we had playing video games. Because, you know, as much as I really liked video games, you know, from the moment I first started playing them, like there was like a sense of I don't know how this thing works.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how games are made back then. So, like, the idea that there could be something spooky hidden in an otherwise, you know, pretty mundane, run-of-the-mill video game wasn't out of the question for me. I don't know. Did you have similar thoughts about video games when you first started playing them?
Sort of. So, it's interesting. A lot of my, like, creepiest memories with games were... not so much with the game as is, you know, like as it was supposed to be played, but it was by like using like cheat devices, like the Game Genie, to like make the game do stuff it wasn't supposed to, and ending up with something that was really unsettling in a way the game was never meant to be. So there was a Game Genie code, and I don't know that we need to explain the Game Genie to people, but usually these things would come with like a code book that would be like, all right, infinite lives, this code, or keep the Hammer Brothers suit in Mario 3. You know, like the people who made the Game Genie would like figure out how these different things worked and then put out a code book like that. But you could also just put in whatever you wanted, just sort of see what happened. And I remember there were two things I can think of really clearly. One of them is in Mario 1, using the code that allowed you to essentially fly. Like, you could jump and then just hold the button to keep going. And if you did that, you could jump over the flagpole at the end of the levels. And what happened then is that you essentially became stuck because there was no way to trigger the game's, like, end of level, like, flag. Like, the gameplay flag, not the literal flag, but that too. And then you could just keep running through a kind of glitched out version of the level until the timer ran out. And it was honestly really creepy because it was like accidentally getting Mario into this weird nightmare condition where there's no way out of it and things are wrong, you know? So stuff like that. And similarly, I just by like messing around with like Mario 3 in the Game Genie, I did a thing one time where if Mario got hit by an enemy, instead of dying, he would just turn green and then all collision detection in the level would be off, basically. So he was basically like a ghost at that point. It had a similarly sort of like unsettling effect. Like, you couldn't end the level, you couldn't do anything, you just sort of had to wait for the timer to run out. But yeah, like, that's the sort of stuff I remember, like, just being like weirdly outside the parameters of the game and feeling like really unsettled by it, you know?
Yeah, you know, I never messed around with the Game Genie quite like that. I just always used the codes that were in the booklets. It never even occurred to me, I guess, that you could just, you know, try stuff and see what happened. But so, you know, it's interesting, though, that you talk about like Mario Brothers and putting Mario in a state where it, like, everything is just off, and like what the implications of that might be to a kid who is trying to interpret it a certain way. So I remember a dream I had as a kid. Oh, this is going to be a really exciting story, right? So I should preface this by saying I was raised Catholic, you know, before I knew any better, that I didn't have to, you know, believe that. And also, if you're Catholic, you should stop that. Be a better version of Christianity or something. Anyway, so I had a dream once that I was playing Super Mario Brothers, the original, and I had done something to get Mario locked into a battle with the devil.
Okay.
And when I lost, instead of getting the regular game over screen, there was just something slightly different about the game over screen. I can't remember what it was exactly. I think like the text was a little bit different. But like the implication being that like because Mario lost a fight with the devil, he's just in hell now. Like he didn't just die. He went to hell. Like Mario's suffering for all eternity now.
His soul is damned.
Yeah.
Wow, that's intense.
Like, I don't want to say like it was like a nightmare, like, you know, bolting upright, drenched in sweat as I wake up, but it was definitely unsettling and it stuck with me. I mean, it stuck with me to the point where I can still remember it today, right?
Yeah.
You know, for all of the retro horror games that are trying to, like, play into, like, you know, how games could glitch out or whatever, I've always wondered, like, what if somebody just decided to make an NES or Super NES style game within the confines of what those systems were capable of and just try to make something scary within that context without, you know, having to bring, like, the meta into it about, like, you know, the implications of a glitched system cursing you or whatever. Yeah. Because there aren't a ton of them. There aren't a ton of, like, really good spooky games for those systems, especially not in North America, like we said.
No, it's true. It's really true. I mean, there are probably more than just this, but the main NES game that I can think of that was actually, like, a proper horror game was Sweet Home, right?
Yeah, Sweet Home, which I was not aware of until, like, you know, probably I was in college. But yeah, that was a that was a very spooky RPG for the NES. Nintendo of America did not want to touch that thing, whether that is because they didn't want to translate all of the text, because they didn't think that a horror game would be popular over here, or if they just were shying away from the more graphic details of the game. Like, there are, you know, like, death sequences for characters in that game when you lose that are pretty graphic. Whatever the reason, they did not want to bring that one over here. One game that I do remember being pretty scared by as a kid was Friday the 13th for the NES.
Oh, yeah, sure. Absolutely.
And not just because the gameplay was bad. The gameplay was very bad. But I do think that for as much crap as that game gets, you know, being labeled like one of the worst games of all time and everything, there were some really effective ideas. There was, like, a deliberate way in which the people who made that game wanted to instill a sense of dread in you. And I think they were pretty effective at it. Like, the game over screen that's just black with text being written, you know, informing you that you and your friends are dead or that all the kids were wiped out. That's creepy. Especially, you know, if that game over comes after, you know, an intense confrontation with Jason, you know, your adrenaline's running. You're just like, oh my God, it's Jason. I got to beat him. You're fighting Jason. And then suddenly the noise to indicate that something's been killed. And then everything just goes black and silent. And the game says, you're dead. And it's like, oh, it gets you. It was effective back then. And I still think it's pretty effective now. I wish that game played better. And
I would like somebody to really go and, like, specifically try to recreate that game or something very much like that game, but with sort of better thought through gameplay mechanics, definitely. Like, I think that could be legitimately very cool.
Yes, definitely. Also, talking about scary games, like, the game overall isn't very scary, but Zelda 2, The Adventure of Link had a very scary game over screen.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that. You know, Ganon Returns.
Yeah,
Return of Ganon.
Yes, right? Yeah, with the laugh. I remember, like, my friend was playing that game, and after that happened, I was like, I don't want to see this game anymore. This one's scary.
I agree, though. There were definitely games with spooky moments in them or things that would just sort of, you know, push a little bit past what you expected to find. And maybe that's the thing, too. It's like video games were such, like, a bright and safe and happy space in a lot of ways that anytime something went to a different place with it, it was really striking. But yeah, like, in terms of actual horror games, it's probably the same answer as many other people have, but frankly, it wasn't until the PlayStation, it wasn't until original Resident Evil that I played something that I think would really classify itself as, like, a proper horror video game. I made it to the hallway where the dogs jump through the window, and it freaked me out so much that I turned the game off and didn't play it anymore.
You just noped right out of there.
I just noped right out. And it was not until, like, a few years later, it wasn't until I was actually, like, a teenager that I started actually being able to play, like, proper horror games and not be kind of overwhelmed by the experience. It's like a thing where, like, I was really excited about Resident Evil in the lead up to it, and I thought it was so cool sounding, and then the actual experience of it was just, like, too much for me. Which, if you look at that game now, that's a very, it's very funny to think about, like, how much, like, you know, expectations change for that kind of thing. But I mean, like, you know, it's it really, it was something that, I'd never seen a game trying to freak me out like that before. And it was pretty effective. Definitely. It was very effective. I'm not going to front.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was like my first experience with a real horror video game.
I think my first experience was like not until college, and it was probably Resident Evil 2 on the, oh no, I guess that would have been high school. Resident Evil 2 on the N64 for me was probably like my first proper horror game. And I played some other things on the N64 that had like a creepy atmosphere. Like I definitely played like some Shadow Man.
Yeah, sure. That's like, that the aesthetic of that game is very like Nine Inch Nails music video, you know?
Yeah, kind of. But I wouldn't necessarily call it like an outright like scary game, although there are one or two jump scares in it. But
right.
It's mostly just like the creepy atmosphere, which I think I prefer these days. Like I'm not very big into jump scares anymore.
I'm not into jump scares. I've really come to appreciate like survival horror gameplay. Like horror games as a thing, I really like, but I don't particularly care for games that are all like the kind of the Five Nights at Freddy's model, where it's just like all about jump scaring you over and over again. Right. And that's like the main goal of the game.
Yeah, I prefer, you know, when a horror game can just really get that feeling of dread going in you know, like like one series that comes to mind for me is Silent Hill.
Sure.
Kind of in a way where, you know, like that whole idea that Mario suffered a worse fate, you know, that I found unsettling in that dream that I had, like Silent Hill, a lot of those games can end in pretty grim ways, like, you know, like getting an actual ending, you know, can be pretty grim.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really true.
Yeah, depending on how you play some of those games, there's something to that for me, like that wanting to avoid that really bad fate, but not entirely knowing what it is that I need to do to keep that from happening. Yeah, that sort of thing is what really fascinates me as far as horror games are concerned now, like something that can just really make you feel that sense of dread. Another game that actually makes me think of that is kind of a spiritual successor to the game we're going to be talking about here in a little bit. That is a Haunting Ground for the PlayStation 2.
Yeah.
We played that together once a long time ago.
We did. We played it. We actually, back in the day, there was a series of videos that are no longer up of us playing Haunting Ground all the way through and having a great time. And that's a game. Yeah, we'll talk about how it relates to Clock Tower, but that is truly a game about making you feel tense and threatened at all times.
Yeah.
You know? So, I have another thing, kind of I was a kid, this was back in the day,
yeah, no, please,
sort of thing,
please,
that I want to mention, just because it was not a scary game, I think most people would agree, but Super Mario 64 had a couple of things in it that the first time I played them were genuinely terrifying to me. Going into the underwater, the first water level, swimming down and seeing the giant eel come into view for the first time.
Yeah.
Terrifying. And also encountering the piano in the Ghost House level, which as you go up to it, it starts trying to eat you with its big, big teeth. And, I didn't expect those kinds of vibes from a Mario game. And, I know the eel thing is not actually that weird. I've actually heard from a lot of people who have had a similar experience with that eel.
Yeah, no, I definitely thought that thing was terrifying.
But yeah, that the eel was second only to the dogs jumping through the window in Resident Evil for like things in games that freaked me out for several years. In terms of games, like as an adult, actual things that gave me, you know, real chills, I'm trying to think of what I would sort of point to as like, oh yeah, that's some real stuff right there. Oddly enough, I can mostly, the horror games that I've really liked have in a lot of cases been things that, frankly, I don't think are that scary. I like Alan Wake a lot. I do not think Alan Wake is a scary game. I think Alan Wake is a thing that is sort of like a more idiosyncratic version of an Uncharted game that is wearing a monster mask, basically. Not a scary game. Original Dead Space, a very fun game, but I would honestly put that game more on the level of like a 3D version of like Alien 3 for the Super Nintendo than something that's actually scary to me. Yeah, in terms of straight up just like horror games that freak me out, I honestly think that it's more stuff where like the writing is really good and effectively creepy. Like there are some visual novels that I've played. One game that I can point to is this game from about a decade ago called Lone Survivor that was basically like a single person project. And it is essentially kind of it's a 2D side-scrolling survival horror game that is very much trying to capture kind of a Silent Hill type of vibe.
Oh, yeah, I remember
and it's
this
really
one, yeah.
Good. It's a really good game and genuinely, I think, really effectively creepy in a pretty profound way. And I will admit, I have a partner who does not really like scary media very much, so it is a bit of a challenge for me to, I don't want to spend, 10 hours hunched over my computer playing a scary game that she does not want any part of.
Yeah.
So generally, I don't tend to play a bunch of them just because I think that, I kind of value being like social while I play games more than locking myself into having like a very particular kind of experience. So, there's a lot of games that I think I would probably really enjoy, but that I haven't really touched just because I don't want to commit the time and energy to that experience. But, I do really like it whenever I do though. So, it's tough to say.
Yeah.
But yeah, Lone Survivor, I would really point to as a very cool, very creepy game.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm kind of in a similar boat. My partner also does not like scary games, so I tend to only play them when she's not around. But like before I got married, I would go out and like try and find little horror nuggets on Steam or other platforms, just to check out. And, there's a lot of games like, I don't even know if I remember the names of them now, but, it didn't, like, fill me with dread, didn't, like, produce a lot of scares. But then I just thought, that was a fun little spooky experience. That was a neat little thing to have gone through. There was one game, it was kind of a puzzle-solving kind of game that was only on the Wii Shop channel called Lit. And I thought that was a really cool.
I remember
cool,
this
yeah.
game.
Yeah.
Yeah, this was a game, the light game, right?
You're basically like a kid trapped in his high school and there are demons everywhere and you can't touch the floor unless you've illuminated it or else the demons will get you. So you have to sort of light your way by using the limited resources you have to like break windows to let light through or turn on, certain light sources to get you from point A to point B. I thought it was a really neat little game. There's a version of it on Steam, but it is very different. Like they've tried to recreate the puzzles with a very different visual style that I don't really think works. I think it's a poor substitute
for the
original. Yeah, it's a shame because that game is basically lost at this point. If you've still got it on a Wii system, which I think I still do somewhere, that's really the only way to play it now in its original form, which is sad. But
yeah,
I liked finding little experiences like that. And I even did, kind of enjoy Five Nights at Freddy's a little bit, like for what it was. I thought it was,
I played the first one of those and not very much, but I thought it was pretty effective at what it was doing.
Yeah, I think like all the sequels were, a case of diminishing returns, frankly. But I thought that first the first initial one of those, I thought, oh, this is an interesting idea, and now, like you've got like creepy pastas and people trying to make games out of creepy pastas and stuff like that. I don't know. Some of those probably work. Like I remember like a creepy pasta.
I played the Slender Man game. That was pretty effective. That's the kind of game that I've kind of really just run out my patience on, so I don't really want that kind of thing anymore. But for what it was, when there wasn't a ton like that, Yeah, good stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Like back in the day when it was, you know, a new thing, that was pretty neat. But yeah, a lot of those games kind of have just the one gimmick, which is, hey, collect these things while something is chasing you and may or may not have the ability to teleport at will and all this. And, you know, after a while, it's like, okay, these are just the same darn game, huh?
ironically, since we did talk about my love and complete sort of like non reaction to the scariness of Alien, I think Alien Isolation is a great horror game. I think that's an exceptional piece of media. I think honestly, maybe Alien Isolation just overall. Second best alien thing that exists after the movie Alien.
Wow. Okay.
Like I really like that game and I do think that game is effective and scary.
That might be one that I have to just watch a long play of. Cause I don't know if I've got the stomach to play that one anymore, but,
that's fair. Yeah. But yeah, that's a really good and genuinely, I think very, very scary game. So yeah.
I do like experiencing some games like that just through long plays and stuff that I know I'm never gonna mm-hmm. play all the way through myself.
Yeah, and I do really like the Resident Evil series. I've played a bunch of Resident Evil games like as an adult, and I'm big fans of them. I generally tend to go more for the action-y Resident Evils, like the ones that are kind of in the mold of Resident Evil 4. Like, there are some of those games that are not good. But, yeah, I like those games. I like the Resident Evil series as a whole. I just don't find it particularly scary. More, like, tense than anything else, but in kind of a white-knuckle action movie kind of way.
I mean, I really like the Resident Evil series as well. In fact, I mean, like, I basically bought the Dreamcast so that I could play Code Veronica. I don't know if I would call it like, you know, one of the best Resident Evil games out there, but it was all right. And then I wanted to find more horror on the Dreamcast and I foolishly purchased The Ring, Terror's Realm.
Another game we've played through together.
We have. Yeah. That one was pretty bad. That was a real bad game.
I have such fond memories of that game. It's a terrible game, undeniably. Yeah. But it's a fun and distinctively weird, terrible game.
Yes, it was fun because we went through it together. That game would have been a slog playing by myself.
Yeah, you don't want to play that alone. I would recommend for people to watch a long play of The Ring, Terror's Realm. Don't actually go play that game. It is not fun to play.
I believe it is. You can still watch a long play of The Ring, Terror's Realm on my YouTube channel. So,
all right. Okay, yeah. Cool.
One of the last things that we did that I left up.
I think that one, that was definitely one of the best things we ever did back in the old days.
Did we do Illbleed too? Did we also do Illbleed?
We did do Illbleed. That's right, yeah. Illbleed was another one that we actually... Did we? I don't remember if we finished Illbleed. I think we got to the last boss and figured out that we had kind of like soft locked ourselves.
Oh no! We did finish it, but we couldn't get the best ending because I couldn't change to a better character. So we kept.
That's right.
Yeah, we kept having that one character die before we could finish it.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, Illbleed is not a scary game, but it's hilarious. It's one of the funniest games I think I've ever seen, honestly.
It's one of the strangest games I think I've ever played that wasn't Seaman.
And speaking, I guess, of things that are adjacent to Seaman, I don't know how I feel about it now, because I've had a lot of time to reflect on it. But I was a big fan for a long time of the game Deadly Premonition, which I do think that game has some very problematic stuff about gender and sexuality that I think has probably aged like rancid milk. Yep. But there are so many things about that game that I think are really interesting and just really kind of right on the line of being really effectively horror moments, and then also being just the goofiest crap you've ever seen.
I'm trying to think. The only other one that I think that I'd want to mention that I haven't brought up yet is Condemned. Criminal Origins. Is that the
sure? Yeah.
I remember picking that up because I, my friends and I had just gotten a 360 on launch day, and that was like one of the two options available for games to play. And we weren't really all that into the aesthetic of Cameo, so we decided to pick up.
That's a good call. Cameo's a bad game. Yeah. Cameo's like not a good game. I've never played Condemned, though. I've heard really good things about it, actually, but I've never played it.
I was kind of thinking it was going to be more along the lines of just like, you know, a first person shooter brawler kind of game with a creepy atmosphere. But it leaned more into horror stuff than I was expecting as we kind of went through it. And I thought it did a lot of that stuff pretty well.
Nice.
Yeah, there's definitely some creepy moments. If you're like me and you are a little bit creeped out by mannequins, you may not like this game because there's a scene in there that oh boy.
Yeah, man, mannequins. There's a creepy mannequins thing in Clock Tower, actually.
There is, and I guess with that segue, it's should we just talk about the our guest of honor here, the Clock Tower?
Let's talk about this Clock Tower.
Yeah. So what did you know about this? I guess a little bit of background here. This is another game that we did play together on the YouTube channel back when we used to do that sort of thing. It's not up anymore. Sorry. But yeah. Did you have any expectations for Clock Tower going into it when we started playing it?
No, I really didn't. I knew generally what it was. And I think I had seen, because Clock Tower had a couple of sequels.
It did.
And I never played those, but I was at least a little more familiar with them than I was with this game. And, you know, I kind of had the sense that it was a creepy game, that it was considered kind of a shame that it never came out in English anywhere. But I didn't know much about it, and I really didn't have much in the way of expectations that it could be effectively scary in some ways. And that was, like, very short-sighted of me for a variety of reasons. But I didn't know what I would actually feel about playing it. I was just kind of intrigued by it, I guess.
Yeah, I did definitely seen some scenes on YouTube of, like, some of the scarier things that happen in the game. Not everything, thankfully, but mm-hmm. But yeah, you know, the whole thing was a lot more effective than I was expecting. You know, I think the game held up surprisingly well. It's like a 2D platformer with
not really a platform.
Well, no, you're right. It takes place on a 2D plane similar to a platformer, but it's really a point and click adventure kind of game.
I see what you're saying. Point click adventure, 3D space represented in 2D, basically.
Yep. And you play as Jennifer, who she and her friends have just been adopted by a creepy lady, because I guess that's something that they'll just let you do. In this world, you know, it's like when you go to the Humane Society expecting to pick up one cat and then you end up with four. I guess it works the same way with it's orphanages like that, yeah. in this world. So yeah, there's like four. I think there's four girls.
There's three girls. I guess there's four girls. There's Jennifer and the three other girls that have all been adopted. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm trying to remember all their names. I think it was like Laura, Lottie.
And I think Anne. Maybe?
Yes, that sounds right.
Anne was the third one. Yeah.
Anne, Laura, and Lottie, I think, are your companions. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, not really companions. You don't see much of them throughout the game.
Not really. Yeah.
Yeah. So basically, you go into another room. You come back. All your friends are gone. The lights are out, and you're trying to figure out what's happened. And so at that point, you're in control, and you are just guiding Jennifer around this mansion. Where a lot of creepy things can happen, and most importantly, you can encounter the Scissor Man, who is a small child with a very large pair of scissors, and if you encounter him, he will chase you around the mansion, and you will have to find a place to hide until he loses interest and goes away. It's a really cool game. Like, when Scissor Man is around, you hear, like, a really great sound effect, sort of like the clashing of the two metal blades together.
It's really good. Yeah. This game makes really effective use of sound effects and of like the kind of, you know, the kind of sounds that the Super Nintendo was very good at making, basically. Yeah, that scissor sound is really good. The bird flapping that you hear a few times is excellent. And yeah, most of the game is sort of without music. You get music at various points for emphasis, like certain rooms have very creepy music. There's a very tense song that plays when the Scissor Man is chasing you. But yeah, for a lot of it, you're hearing basically Jennifer's footsteps and then the sound of whatever she's interacting with.
Yeah, and I've watched some other long play or let's plays of the game, and I think some people are annoyed by the lack of music, but I rather like it in this game. I think it's pretty effective.
I think it's very good. I think it's very effective. It's not a really long game either, so I don't think that there's not like a ton of time between moments where things are punctuated by music, but the music is very much there as punctuation and not just as general sort of mood setting background, you know?
Yeah. And another thing that I really like about this game is that events can unfold pretty differently, but depending on how you approach it. I'm still not entirely sure like what triggers what, or if some of this is just kind of based on RNG. Certain characters will die if you, you know, go into certain places and find them. But if you don't find them, then they might still be alive later in the game. At least two of the rooms are actually randomized. I think there's like a couple of rooms where they can actually be in different locations.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's also, it seems like, from what I've read about the game, there's basically two different ways to sort of get to the final area of the game.
Right.
And which way you're going to need to get there sort of depends on what objects you find. And again, I think there's a little bit of RNG involved here, because like sometimes an item that you need to unlock one passageway just won't be there, so you need to go find the other one. And there's also like big story elements that you could potentially miss out on because they're not required to beat the game. So there's a lot of interesting things going on here. I think my one big issue with this is that, you know, if you don't know what you're looking for, you can kind of hit a brick wall with this game. Mm-hmm. And I think that it would have been more interesting to maybe give the player more ways of kind of solving you know, the big puzzle of the mansion to sort of get to the last area. Cause I think it's more interesting to like, let the player keep going, let the player keep digging. And maybe like, if they don't quite go about it the way you wanted them to, maybe put some kind of obstacle in the way that would, you know,
that would kind of force them onto a path that would,
yeah. Like, you know, maybe like, hey, there's going to be consequences for doing it this way. Like, you go down there if you want to, but you know, things are going to get pretty messed up if you go down there, let's just say, you know, like things are going to get messed up regardless, but
yeah. Definitely. I mean, I like that there are a couple of different potential like solutions basically to some of these things, and that it doesn't seem like the game like kind of soft locks you just based on your choices, which is good. But I do agree that like, the combination of the kind of sort of cumbersome interface and how black and white some of the solutions can be does mean that you can kind of spend a lot of time going around in circles in a way that feels really grating. And I don't love that about it in the kind of worst case scenario.
There's also a few little like kind of pop scare like moments where, you know, like you'll see a close up of something that you've just examined. And it's usually a little more than just kind of window dressing, like just to try and, you know, get you a little bit, you know, unnerved, which I do kind of like. I think that can work, but it also like you know, if you're expecting that to mean something within the context of the game, other than just like, oh, spooky thing happened.
Yeah.
You might get a little disappointed. Like, hey, did I just see a body in that closet? Yeah, you did. Does that mean anything?
Not really. No.
It's just a random thing that can happen. Although in later versions of the game, they did make that an actual like boss encounter.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
That it's not in the Super Famicom version, although maybe it'll be in the
upcoming remake. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's an interesting question, because like that's the thing we didn't say. Clock Tower may not have come out in America, but it was actually a pretty popular game in Japan, and it got several re-releases that added little bits of other content. Like there's, you know, I think the main one is the PlayStation version. That did add, you know, a completely different musical score and, you know, various gameplay things that showed up in later releases of it. So, yeah, I'm curious about what that Way Forward version that's coming out in early 2024 is going to pull from. I was watching some footage of the original Super Famicom version today, and I was really surprised at how many different like minute, you know, variations of kind of the sort of golden path like canon ending for this game there are. Like there's so many different like odd little details that can show up in the final like 10 minutes of this game, and I'm not really sure what triggers those, honestly.
Like in the best ending of the game, you make it out with one of your friends, but who that friend is can change, and you can't save more than one in any given playthrough. So that's kind of an interesting wrinkle to how they decided to do that.
Yeah.
Cause you know, you would think like, oh, there must be like a best ending where you save as many people as possible. And it's like, nope, you can only save one of them and it's a different person. One of them is completely unsavable no matter what you do. Mm-hmm. And it's not always obvious what it is that kind of changes the outcome in those last couple minutes either. You know, and it is a shame because, yeah, once you know all of this, once you've read up on this, like you said, the game isn't very long. So, you know, replayability is a bit on the low side maybe for this game.
Maybe. I mean, I guess it's replayable in the sense that a bunch of different things can happen, but given that those aren't super under your control in a lot of cases, it's not quite the same feeling as like a visual novel where you can replay it like five or six different times and have like very different paths happen based on intentional choices you've made, you know? It's just sort of like, all right, I'm going to roll the dice on another Clock Tower playthrough and see what happens this time.
Yeah. But I do like games that have like the multiple endings, and some are going to be better than others.
Yeah.
You know, and this game has, I mean, you know, you can die obviously.
Sure. Of course.
But there's like different ways in which that can happen. You know, you're not always just going to get taken out by the Scissor Man in a random hallway. Sometimes there will be, you know, like certain story beats that, you know, will lead to you needing to make a decision. And if you make the wrong one, or maybe just don't have an item that you needed, you won't survive the encounter.
Right.
There's one very memorable one in the garage that happens if you get caught by Miss Mary, which basically like once that happens to you, if you don't have a certain item, you're already dead. There's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah.
If that happens, I don't know if I want to spoil it, but there's a real gnarly sound effect that accompanies that particular death. And
yeah, I know what you're talking about, and it's rough. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really grim, but it's also like just, yeah, it's, but again, like it's good horror, right? You know,
it's good horror. Good, yeah. Like, oh. Well, and I like also that like, okay, so there's, like I said, there's kind of the main, there is a good ending to this game in the sense that there's an ending in which Jennifer and maybe one of her friends can survive. But like, there's also at least one other really fleshed out bad ending that is almost kind of a fake out ending where it seems like a pretty obvious solution to the problem. And it's pretty like elaborately depicted But it's also not a good ending for the game. It's not an ending where anything good happens. And I think it's really cool that they put that in here as sort of like a red herring for like what the solution to this problem might be, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like there's two endings that like are considered endings, but basically, you know, are deaths essentially. Yeah. Yeah, there's at least two I can remember. I don't know if there's more than that, but yeah, the one that you're talking about is very well produced in a way that makes me kind of wish that there were more of those to be found throughout and the game, you know, like,
yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think it would be really cool if there were like three or four of those in addition to the main like proper ending. I do think, from what I understand, this was a very, very tight budget on this game. Like, I know they wanted to include mouse support and they simply couldn't because they didn't have the money to. So, yeah, I mean, we're talking about a game here where all of the animations for Jennifer were basically digitized versions of them getting, you know, a woman who worked in the office to do various stunts and filming it. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's wild. That's so cool.
So yeah, the animations, some of the animations look really good, and it's because that's what they are. Like her like hanging from a ledge or like, you know, jumping down from something. That's what that was. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Almost like Mortal Kombat or something.
Pretty much, yeah, in some ways, yeah. So, you know, this is a game that was really doing a lot with not very much in the way of resources. So I can't, like, I wish that there was more to a lot of this, but I'm really impressed with the fact that they were able to make something this good with the resources they had available to them.
Yeah, and I mean, by most accounts, you know, like, never knocked it out of the park in quite this way ever again. Like, this game saw two direct sequels. And neither of them, I think, are very well regarded. I think we played a little bit of Clock Tower 3 on the PS2, but
we did. I mean, Clock Tower 3, I should have looked this up, but I suspect Clock Tower 3 maybe wasn't even really made by a lot of the same people that worked on this one. I know Clock Tower 2 was. It was a Capcom. Yeah. 3 was a Capcom game. And like, that's not. So like, this game was made, original Clock Tower and Clock Tower 2 were made by Human Entertainment, which is a real interesting company that's like mostly known as like the starting point for both the Fire Pro Wrestling series and it being like the place where like Goichi Suda got his start before he formed Grasshopper Entertainment. But the other big thing they are known for is the Clock Tower series. So I don't know how Clock Tower ended up in Capcom's hands, but they did make Clock Tower 3, which is, yeah, not, it doesn't really feel very much like this.
Yeah, I don't know exactly how the lineage works out, because I'm wanting to say that like Haunting Ground, as we mentioned before, was kind of a spiritual successor to to the Clock Tower series. And this one, I think, like, nails the, you know, the dread and sort of the hide and go seek, you know, hide and go seek sort of gameplay of Clock Tower.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how many people who were directly involved in original Clock Tower, if any, worked on Haunting Ground,
but the inspiration is very clear in that game.
Yeah. And it's honestly like the only game that matches, you know, Clock Tower and in quality, I think. And again, like,
I agree. Yeah.
Haunting Ground has its problems too. Like, as we have said before, that game falls off a cliff in its last half, but
yeah, they make a really unfortunate Haunting Ground makes a really unfortunate choice in what the pursuing antagonist creature is for the last third. That is like the least fun thing you can have chasing you, basically.
Yeah.
You know, but up to that point, it's very effective at doing many of the same things Clock Tower does, but in like a very an expanded and kind of really, really sort of interestingly mechanically developed way.
Yeah. And then there was also that independent game that came out that was also meant to be kind of a spiritual successor to Clock Tower, except it took place on a boat.
Yes, that one actually was worked on by people who, I was reading about this earlier. That one actually was worked on by people who worked on Clock Tower.
Yeah, do you remember the name of that game? It is, I feel like the name Cry is in there somewhere.
Night Cry, yeah.
Night Cry, there we go. Yeah, from what I've seen of that game and heard of that game, I don't think it's very good.
Yeah.
Or, like, it's maybe kind of weird in, like, an almost, like, Deadly Premonition so bad it's kind of good sort of way.
Yeah, but I think not in the fun way that Deadly Premonition is. So, like, basically, Night Cry was made by a developer called Nude Maker, which is a very funny name for a developer, which was formed of kind of people that used to work at Human Entertainment and had worked on Clock Tower. It was directed by Hifumi Kono, who was the original creator of the Clock Tower series. But yeah, I think it was just exceptionally janky and sort of like not, I don't know. It just wasn't good. I wish that I knew more about it to say like how exactly it wasn't good. But I know that a lot of people were like very excited for it and ended up pretty disappointed by it.
I feel like I've tried to watch a long play of this and maybe got bored and didn't finish it for some reason, or maybe it just didn't leave enough of an impression on me that I forgot most of it. I don't know, but
no, it does have a guy with big scissors, but yes. not much else to recommend it, you know. The presentation in Clock Tower is very good, but you would never mistake it for anything but a Super Nintendo game. And it's just so interesting to see somebody using the tools available at that time on that system to do something that is genuinely, genuinely creepy and unsettling this way. And,
yeah,
you know, it honestly just makes me want to see more people take on that challenge of like using the limitations of 16-bit hardware to explore different vibes and different genres that weren't particularly well represented back in the day when these were like kind of a going concern.
Yeah, I would love to see that. I would love to see somebody try to make like a proper spiritual successor to the original Famicom Clock Tower and like make it like that. And obviously, you know, like, you know, animating sprites and all this stuff is hard. People would probably prefer to use modern tools and, you know, and I think that's probably fine. I mean, you know,
I think that kind of game probably does exist. It's probably just like not a thing either of us are super aware of, you know?
Yeah, probably.
Like I have to imagine somebody's out there trying to do stuff like that. And if they're not, yeah, they really should be.
I could definitely see a lot of games like that being made with modern tools, but they're not very good, you know?
Uh-huh.
I could definitely see that being a problem. Yeah. So I don't know.
I think a lot of the energy right now is focused on using the weird, uncanny nature of like PS1 era graphics to make horror games, actually.
Yeah.
And I think that can be really effective. Like there's some really good games that have come out using that as sort of the aesthetic template. I'm just interested in stuff that pushes a little further back than that. That's pretty much what Lone Survivor, the game I talked about earlier in the show, kind of is. Like it looks like something very much from like the pre-3D era, but is using a lot of the sort of tools for you know, disconcerting and unsettling the player that have been developed in like the 3D era. So yeah.
But more of that. Make more of that. Somebody should make more of that. Maybe I'll make more of that. I need to learn how to make games, but I won't do it on Unity.
No, sir. No, sir.
Well, I don't know. Is there anything else we want to say about Clock Tower?
Not really. I will say, if you have looked at footage of this game or are going to look at footage of this game and you're like, why does the main character look exactly like teenage Jennifer Connelly?
Oh, yeah.
That was intentional. This game is pretty heavily inspired by the 1985 Dario Argento movie Phenomena, which did star Jennifer Connelly. And they just were like, well, you know, why not? Let's just make her look exactly like her, exactly like that.
Maybe that's why it didn't come out over here. They were worried that Jennifer Connelly would sue them.
Maybe. Definitely didn't get permission to do that. So I don't know. But that's the only thing I wanted to say. Clock Tower is pretty easily available to an English-speaking audience these days. There is going to be an official English release of it for the first time early in 2024, courtesy of WayForward. But even without that, there are very good, very easily attainable English fan translation patches for the Japanese Super Famicom game. So I would say if any of this sounds interesting to you and you can put up with a slightly cumbersome point-and-click interface, go play this game. It's a lot of fun, and it's perfect for the spooky season. So we hope you're all enjoying the time of ghouls and goblins and ghosties out there, and... yeah, we'll be back to our normal stuff next week. But actually, we were going to rank this one. I forgot. We were going to rank this game. So let's talk about that before we go.
Yeah, definitely.
Top of your head, where do you think Clock Tower lands on our tier list?
So I'll be honest. I think Clock Tower holds up surprisingly well for a point-and-click game on the Super Nintendo that doesn't have mouse support.
Yeah.
Gameplay-wise, atmosphere-wise, you know, there's a few annoyances in there, but I think overall, like, this is a very, very playable game in 2023. I am tempted to call this an A game, unless you think its flaws are a little bit too much to be...
I do not think the flaws are enough to you know, tarnish it that way. I think this is an A tier game. I think this is a distinctively effective and really fun experience. And truly, there's not much else like it on the Super Nintendo. So yeah, I say this is an A tier game. And yeah, anybody who has listened to this episode and thinks this game sounds interesting, go play it. I think you'll have a good time.
Yeah, there's a translated version of the ROM out there. You don't even have to patch anything or anything like that to play it. So yeah, it's incredibly accessible. And like you were saying, there is going to be a remake of this game coming out sometime in the next year. So if you really, really anti-piracy, you know, you can do it that way too. But it's not like anyone's made this game super easy to play in North America, and so yeah, I don't feel too bad about it, but yeah, but anyway, so I think that's gonna do it. So folks, I hope you liked this pretty different episode of Cinescapades. You know, I just felt like doing something for Halloween this year, and yeah, that's what we did. We decided to talk about Clock Tower, even though it is not usually the kind of game that we would discuss on this show, being a Famicom exclusive.
But until next time, we hope you stay safe and, you know, watch out for the goblins out there, and have a safe and happy Halloween, everybody.
Yep. And watch out for the scissor man.
Yep. He's right behind you.
Oh, my gosh. He's scissoring me. No, wait a minute.
No, that's different.
Okay.
That's very different. All right, folks. Play it loud. Play it spooky. We'll see you next time.
Happy Halloween.
Place in the New York Cemetery. Oh, it was a zombie jamboree. Took place in the New York Cemetery. Zombies from all parts of the island. Some of them were great Calypsonians. Since the season was carnival, they got together in Bacchanal. And they were singing back to back, come on, belly to belly. I don't give a damn, cause I'm stone dead already. Back to back, ha, belly to belly. A zombie jamboree. One female. female zombie. She won't behave. See how she's dancing out of the grave. In one hand she's holding a quart of rum, the other hand is knocking a conga drum. You know the lead singer starts to make his rhyme, while the other zombies are rocking in time. One bystander, he had this to say: it was a trip to see the zombies break away. And they were singing back to back, come on, belly to belly. I don't give a damn, cause I'm stone dead already. Back to back, ha, belly to belly, a zombie jamboree. And they were singing back to back, come on, belly to belly. Well, I don't give a damn, cause I'm stone dead already. Back to back, whoa.